But I want to thank you for inviting me. I thought, found this, this all very interesting and stimulating. So I'm going to talk about, this talk is inspired by, again, one of these popular physics books. This is the first 3 minutes I read this, and I said, this actually makes a lot of sense. Okay, so the idea is that the universe is created in some sort of big bang. And you can tell this was a big bang because when you look at the universe with these weird sorts of things, everywhere you look, the temperature of the universe is about the same. And so they came up with these things, big bang equation. Okay, and then the idea that many of the rules were created at the time of creation. Okay, so I thought, well, this is pretty good. Okay, so what are the alternate models of creation? If you're going to say something's created, how do you actually model this? Okay, and so the easiest one is stepwise. You have to start somewhere and you keep adding things, okay? And that's actually very logical, and many models are based on that. So the Big Bang is true, but it requires a lot of stranger thinking, right?
Because, how do you know it's true?
Well, we'll say it's what?
It's what consensus opinion.
Yeah, it's a consensus. It's what Steven Weinberg wrote about.
Okay.
So he must be right because he has a Nobel Prize. He's like a pathologist. He's very...
Exactly.
Okay, but it requires much stranger reasoning. So this is the stepwise is very logical. And then the question is there what are the other ways of creating things? Okay, so I know this way and I know this way. The other ways, there are probably other ways, but they're very, very complicated, and so on. Okay, so in biology, we think stepwise. So when we look at development, we say, well, start out as a zygote, then you have this, and this, and this, and this. And then cancer is supposed to be aberrant development, so of course it's a stepwise model. And everyone looks at this, and you sort of intuitively understand it and think, well, this must be the way it happens because it looks right. Okay. Of course, in a weird way, development is actually a big bang too, in a weird sort of way, because this is the homunculus, because a long time ago people really didn't know how development occurred, so they thought that there was this little man in the sperm and then he turned into a big man. Okay, but we know that you get half your genome from your mother and half from your father. And this is actually, in a weird way, a singularity because of recombination. You actually don't know what sort of original germline genome you're going to have. But in a weird sense, once this happens, then all of this is actually predestined, you know, because all the information is there, and you really don't have to do anything, and you end up with a baby. Okay, which is sort of like the creation of the universe. Once it happened, it was destined to do what happened. Okay, so the problem in cancer is that we really don't know how human cancers evolve because we can't watch what happens. And so it could be stepwise, where you go from a little tumor becomes a big tumor, something else happens, you get a bigger tumor, you get invasion. Or it could be that you get a single cell that transforms, it already has its full malignant potential, it looks different, but this is just phenotypic plasticity, so it's the same cell basically everywhere. It looks so the head's behavior is a little different just because it responds to its microenvironment, but it's essentially the same. And so if we look here, the age of this thing, the first area would be older, and you'd be progressively younger. And then in this case, with a single clonal expansion, all of it would be about a uniform age. Okay. And then the other interesting thing, and this is what a lot of people don't talk about, is how do tumors grow, okay? Because if you knew how tumors grew, then the kinetics would tell you something. And from what most people think, and they used to do this in the 60s, where they used to use radiographs and try and figure out how tumors grow, tumors typically exhibit Gompertzian growth, where the initial cell, there's an initial exponential growth, and then the tumor growth slows down. So about the time it becomes visible, about 1 centimeter in size, the tumor is actually growing quite slowly. Okay, and that's why you need a pathologist, because if the tumor kept doubling all the time, you wouldn't need a pathologist, you just need a weekend. You'd say, was that a tumor? You know, if you see a little spot. Well, we'll know by the weekend because it'll be much bigger. But actually, the growth of most human tumors, once you see them, actually is not very high. Okay, so it has this downward seeing growth. And in, at least in the colon, when you find these tumors, they actually look pretty symmetrical. Okay? And I guess.
So that's a colon cancer that you're showing?
Yeah, right here. This is the normal colon, and this is the colon cancer.
So this curve that you're showing is derived from the.
No, this is actually just the general curve work.
So that's a model.
This is what people think happens.
But many tumors don't necessarily have that symmetry, right? I
mean, well, that's what it, yeah.
Many don't, but a lot of times in the colon, they actually have this symmetry. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's so symmetric, you can do what a physicist would do, and he would rotate it and say, it still looks the same, right? And you say, well, apparently that's important in physics, where you rotate frames and things still look the same. So in fact, a lot of times if the surgeon is interested in what margin, what side, right side versus left side, we specifically have to ink or add a mark so that we remember what side it is, because if we turn away and we go, oh no, which is the right side or the left side, we won't know, because a lot of times it's just a symmetrical object.
And physicists would infer from that it goes from the middle out.
Well, we don't know, but it's sort of, it could be in the middle and then grow out. Right?
I thought there was a polyp which has a stalk, and then so it does go from the middle out, which is why it's symmetrical.
Yeah, it could be. That's the stepwise model, or it could just grow out once. So, okay. So that's another observation. So the idea is that there are there analogous approaches. We start at the universe, it starts out in one place, undergoes apparently this massive expansion, and then it slowly grows, and then apparently because there's dark energy, it's going to start to accelerate. Okay, similarly, we have a single tumor cell. It grows exponentially or doubles exponentially, and then it slows down at this. So this is what we see. This is what we see, started from a single point. Okay, so maybe there are things in common that we can use to describe it. I was told last night at dinner there is no equation that describes the expansion of the universe. And actually, I was horribly disappointed, because I thought I just didn't understand the math, and then somewhere the equation was there, but apparently. So, anyway. Okay, so the idea then is, if you could look here and describe this time here, it might be possible to look here and actually describe the very beginning here. Here, the age is, I guess, one of the things you use for age here in the universe is the temperature of the universe, and you say, wow, everywhere I look, it's about 3 degrees, and so it's uniform. For cancer, the age we're going to have is diversity. It's also the increase in entropy, basically, but diversity is going to be the differences in the genomes between the cells, which should increase with time. Okay, so how do we create biological time and space? What is the mechanism that creates biological time and space? So the mechanism could be cell division. So time, biological time, could be different from regular time, chronologic time. But here would be a mitotic age, division since a common ancestor. So every cell would have a certain number of divisions since a common ancestor. Space would be the cells. You don't have anything there, and a tumor grows out to create tumor space. And so it's just the cells that didn't used to be there, and then were created by division. So asymmetric division, one cell that lives, one that dies. This would maintain space. And then symmetric divisions, where you produce two cells of the same fate, we either create or destroy space, okay? And we can so see this in a zygote. Basically, in a zygote, you start with one cell, get a bunch of cells, all the cells basically in the same, since they started from the same place, and you basically have an exponential growth. All these cells have about the same mitotic age. This again occurs all at once, and it occurs spontaneously. So once you get the zygote growing.
I actually do not understand how you're trying to distinguish these two scenarios. Even with clonal expansion, if I really counted it all the lag time, so are you trying to say there are different number of divisions for different parts of the tumor? That's one scenario.
Uh-huh.
And really in a developed organ, there are different cells. are guaranteed to have roughly the same number of divisions?
But it more or less, it could have the same number of divisions.
It could have, or it is true.
No, but epithelial cells have many, many
divisions. Yeah. So, but in the beginning, in the very beginning, it's a pretty uniform. It's a pretty uniform population. Okay, because of this inflation, it's just one big.
Sorry. So is it true in embryogenesis that neuroendocrine cells, that the different cell precursors fill the same volume in the baby at birth?
No, because different cells have different size, amounts of size.
Yeah, but so can you actually count the number of divisions from one? If you just take.
You should be able to, and they do it for like worms, they know every cell division and things like that, but for...
Well, maybe that picture is slightly misleading, because by that time already there are different regions that are growing at different rates.
Yeah. Okay. But I guess what I really want to say here is that all this occurs all at once. In this sort of developmental thing, you don't actually have to make half a baby and then hope that you're going to get another mutation or something's going to happen. Basically, this is just predetermined. Okay, so you don't really need any selection or evolution. Okay. In contrast, if you have a tumor, it could occur like this, where it sort of has the full malignant potential at the time of transformation, or it could require a stepwise process where you grow a little bit and then you reach some sort of barrier and then you need another mutation. And so this would be the Death Star scenario where you sort of are limited. And then because you have a lot of cells that are under different selective pressures, then you can get another mutation and have another capability and outgrow. And so that's sort of the conventional idea. Okay, and so we're going to use the coalescent. We just use copies of copies and then compare the genomes. Okay, so a lot of people sometimes ask me, are you going to draw reconstruct phylogenies? And you know, you're going to draw trees like this. And I say, well, I'm not, because the number of possible trees are actually quite large, and this is just an equation for bifurcating trees. So there are many, many possible trees, and I'm actually just trying to figure out the general shape of trees right now, because there's just, you can't say this happened to any great detail just because it's a complex problem. Okay, so this is a blow-up of an adenocarcinoma, and it's sort of like a Death Star, because even though they don't construct it, each one of these little holes here is a cancer gland, okay? So each one of these, even this is a big tumor, it's actually subdivided into multiple small glands, and each one of these glands is distinct from another gland, so cells within a gland stay within a gland, and they can't really migrate freely or diffuse between glands. Okay, so there's all these little glands here, and so there's a tremendous amount of topography physical structure to a solid.
Many microhabitats there, right?
Many, many microhabitats. Some are near here, some are up here, but they're all basically microhabitats, and like. Your thing, there are no channels where they can freely diffuse between them. They're basically stuck in these little...
Are they really... I mean, is there any cellular movement back and forth at all, or are they really fixed?
Yeah, I think they're pretty fixed because most of these cells are still attached to a basement membrane because they're a glandular carcinoma. So if they actually detached in some way, they would probably die. It doesn't mean that migration won't occur, but it's probably unlikely.
Yeah, because I was reading about like pancreatic cancer. It's supposed to be such a killer because the cells migrate in the tissue, right? Uh-huh. So maybe that's true for the colon cancers, but other cancers, there is actually migration.
Yeah, so a lot of times you'll see cells breaking off and migrating and things like that. This is a convenient way of sort of, you can grab cells that are adjacent to each other and have probably been adjacent to each other.
So during metastasis, they do break away.
They have to break away because, let's say, metastasis. Yeah, the whole gland doesn't sort of migrate. It's individual cells that break off. Question?
Just like to understand the morphology here a little bit better. So these white holes that we're looking at, there are vasculature or?
This is the surface, outside surface of the colon. This would be the inside where the feces are, or the poop, okay? This is a normal colon here. This is a barrier here. And the white areas you see are, in many ways, if you were a little man, you could go inside these white areas. This is the lumen.
So I guess the first question is, what is the scale of this?
Okay, so this is probably about 2 centimeters from here to here.
And that little fold in the corner, are a few folds, are crypt size?
Here?
Yeah, those.
Yeah, so that's a crypt here.
And the glands are like the orc version of the crypts or something. The glands are pseudo crypts in here or no?
These here?
What do you call glands?
These are cancer glands.
Uh-huh.
They're tubular structures filled with cancer cells.
So the normal morphology is completely disrupted at this stage?
At this stage, there used to be normal here and something grew, say, in the center and then just grew out and disrupted the normal morphology.
Wait. So I'm completely confused, right? So that nice fold that we see on the left there, right?
This
seems like sort of a single layer.
Yeah,
yeah, just below, right? Yeah. So this is more of a single undulating layer of cells. So that's a cross-section of a crypt.
Uh-huh.
That I think we more or less capture. But the rest of it is completely unrecognizable, right?
Yeah,
or
so this,
do you recognize normal structure?
No, there is no normal. This whole thing here is a tumor.
So these cells are no longer epithelial.
They are epithelial.
No,
and
so is there a sense of apical and basal?
This is from the monolayer.
Yeah, so this would be a gland and it has an apex and then you could go down. I don't know how far it would go down, but it actually has a top and somewhere there might be a bottom. We, you know, is it sort of spaghetti-like as it goes in here? These are all these glands.
But if somebody asked you to identify a stromal cell versus an epithelial cell, would you be able to do that?
Yeah, so here, it's like these are stromal cells here, and there's stromal cells all over the tumor. So there's a like basically a single layer epithelium, and then there's stromal cells next to it.
So can you point to a cell in that mess?
Okay, the cells are little bitty points here. And
so for example, what are we staining? Purple
is usually nuclei, and purple is usually nuclei.
So this is really a 3D structure which has been flattened into 2D.
No, it's a 3D structure that's been...
Oh, it's a section of a 3D structure.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So I think structure is important. In
principle, you really should look at all those layers, too. There is a 3D object here, and we're just looking at a cross-section of a complex 3D thing.
Yeah, it's as if you chop someone like this, and then you see.
So did you have overgrowth of the stroma as well to get these structures? Or did you basically fold very complexly in 3D a monolayer?
It could be a very complex 3D structure. It probably started... I'll show later what I think is happening in a very simplistic manner. But I just wanted to show this because I think a lot of times they don't give you all the information you need to figure out what cancers are. I can tell you've probably never seen a cancer then. Very, very, you know, in this sort of detail.
But this is not the first 3 days, right? This is your exponential expansion presumably occurred earlier, presumably there is much earlier stage of dysregulation where one still recognizes the crypts, right? In much more normal morphology.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll show in
so
more
I guess
detail.
How many stages
nobody
later
knows.
Is this?
See, this tumor comes out and nobody knows the age of this tumor. You know, because it just looks like this. This could be 1 month old because it's 30 cell divisions to use of billions of
but
cells.
But is this basically, so and what one never actually finds some sort of smaller polyps that...
Oh yeah, you can find smaller tumors. Like this could be a smaller tumor so the idea is
it would be so instructive to sort of see, right, as a pathologist, right?
Uh-huh.
You presumably have a very good idea of what the progression is, even though it's not in a single patient that you can see it.
But then you get this sort of picture here. which I think is horribly misleading. It's sort of one thing happens, another thing happens, and another thing happens. Okay, that's the typical picture. And it's very easy to comprehend, but it may not actually be correct.
And did people reconstruct 3D confocal? Did 3D confocal imaging on these structures?
They are beginning to, but they get very complicated, and for some reason, no one's interested in it. To many people, a tumor is a tube of DNA. It's a circle people draw. because it is simplified because you just. This could be just, you don't even need any structure, and it's just cancer stuff.
Do you know when the blood vessels are in situ?
I'll show you in more detail a little bit what... Uh-oh, I'm going the wrong way. Okay, anyway. Okay, so that I just thought it'd be interesting to show this. And then, so what we think happens is that there's a normal gland, or it could be a gland in a polyp, and you get the first transformed cell in it somewhere, okay? And this looks relatively normal, so. And then it fills up that gland, okay? One cell turns into another cell, okay? And then for some reason, when glands get too big, because you don't get one huge cancer gland, it undergoes what we call crypt fission. So one cancer gland will split into two cancer glands, and then the cancer glands will keep splitting, okay? And so this would be during the exponential growth. It's not just cells that are growing in exponential, but also there are little compartments. You get this crypt fission. So they're sort of correlated to each other. Not only do you get increased numbers of cells, but it's the glands that also undergo an exponential expansion. And then in the end, there's no growth. Okay, or the growth slows. Okay, and so a lot of times when we do this, we just start out with an exponential growth and then no growth. It's because it's easy to accumulate. And then we just say, okay, under these various scenarios, what sort of changes would you see to the genome? And then so instead of drawing trees, we do a bunch of simulations where we have each gland, we pick multiple glands and we pick their averages, and we see what sort of scenarios are more consistent with the scatter of our data, how different are the different genes.
You're doing that with methylation?
This is with methylation, yeah. So I'll show you. But this is basically our approach. We give some extreme scenarios. What if there's one cancer cell, one cell, long
with simulation, but yeah. In practice, you'll do it differently.
So yeah. Where's the data in this?
This is simulation.
Yeah. So here, these are the number. So here we sample eight methyl alleles, or alleles, epi alleles from one of these things. We asked, doing that, how many unique tags, how many different patterns would we see? And then under different scenarios, like if you have one stem cell, then basically you always see basically one. If you have everyone was a stem cell, then you have a lot more of these patterns as you increase mitotic age. Okay, so these are just the sort of very simple scenarios, which is probably even too complicated for the limited amount of data I have. But it sort of, it sort of shows you what sort of data you might expect under different scenarios. And so what we're really trying to do right now is just look at the basic tree shapes. This is a cancer gland, this is another cancer gland. In one, you all start with a single transformed cell, but the idea is in a cancer gland, is it many long-lived lineages, or is this one or two? Okay. And it turns out this is the more likely answer. Okay. Which is the worst possible scenario for generating pre-existing resistant variants, because you have all these long-lived lineages. Every time a variant occurs during along this thing, it's preserved because it doesn't die out. There are very few dead ends, which is here. All the cells tend to have the same, there's less overall diversity. Okay, so that's what we see. And this is sort of the approach that cancer comes out. I rush in because usually the resident will grab a piece of tumor and then he'll put the rest of the tumor in formalin, which kills the DNA. So what I really want to do is sample from defined areas. So I get a piece of tumor and I sample from right side and then the left side. Of course, there's symmetry, so I arbitrarily say this is the right side and this is the left side. Okay, and then I isolate multiple small cancer glands. So these are the units of cells that are next to each other, okay? And then I do my thing where I go and get, this is one cancer gland, this is one epithelial, another epithelial. So I sample multiple times from, in this case, six different glands. Okay, the same sequence, and I look for variants between them.
Which gene? Are you looking at some specific gene?
Yeah, this is those Fe alleles. I'm looking at the 5' to 3' area of methylation.
Of what gene?
This is for BGN and LOC. These are two loci on the X chromosome. Okay. So it reduces the in male patients, so it reduces the complexity. Okay, and then we can play games and, you know, compare the diversity within a gland, then between glands on the same side, and then between glands on the other side. Okay, you can do this. Okay, so when we do this, this is 12 tooth cancers, and I'm comparing now the diversity between the right side and left side, looking at the epithelials. And we see when we do that between the sides that some cancers, the differences are not very big between the right and left side. In other ones, they're bigger, and you can draw some sort of curve. It bends over because you get saturation. But what we can see here is that based on this, some of the cancers appear to have been taken out very shortly after transformation, and some have been taken out a little bit longer. And we can play games. This is just estimating mitotic age. But when we do this, most of the cancers here have an age consistent with 1 or 2 years after transformation. Okay, so we don't get impossible scenarios if we say this is a year. We don't see cancers that are taken out after a week and maybe a month or two. And we don't see cancers that have been there for 20 years. Okay, so we can sort of get some sort of reasonable range. Okay, and of course, this is just an estimate. But it does show what you would expect, that cancers get taken out different times after transformation. Question?
So how confident are you in the sign of mitotic age?
I'm not very confident at all. This is just an average of the pairwise distance between the sides, and just to show that they were different. This is probably not a good... This is sort of testing, you know. What if they all have the same age? Then that would mean that you're just measuring something that doesn't appear to be correlated with time, maybe.
But so the way you transform mitotic age into years, as far as I can tell, you just divided this by
365.
365.
Yeah. It's very simple, but.
If you went from the surface, which is clearly closest to the stroma of the tumor, upwards, would you see a migration along the path somehow? Could you tell what's going on? So, if, for example, in the universe, if you go outwards, you can see that the redshift is increasing. We have a marker for what means, what time means.
Uh-huh.
Do you have such a marker in?
So you're asking, am I going to act like a physicist?
You are acting like a physicist. I'm just saying, to what extent taking yourself seriously as a physicist?
Yeah, I'll show you a little later, okay? Because the redshift is something we see, but in reality, the universe is all the same age, right?
Yeah, but your cells could be growing at different rates.
Yeah.
And effectively, they could be different ages.
Yeah. So I actually want to test it, and I'll show you later on how I test it.
Can I ask you a more trivial question?
Uh-huh.
Yes. Which is that most of the left-right pairs would map into the central cluster, or you are saying? So there are pairs which came from the one came from the left, one came from the right.
Uh-huh.
Those are superficially, you think, the most distant ones.
Yeah.
And they are who here? They are mostly in the middle, and there's a few rare ones which are very different from.
Yeah, I think it'll become
a little bit surprised that your longest stage,
uh-huh,
there are only a few. So is it because of what? When one guy looked very different from everyone
here
else?
The pairwise difference is just really big. On average, the alleles from here are very different from the ones over here.
But why is there only one point then? Or they're all on top of each other?
No, there is just only one point here, and it would say that most people, if I took this seriously, I'd say most people don't run around with a malignant cancer in them for a long time before they get taken out. So this would be someone who if we take this literally, was having walking around with a cancer that's going to, that could kill him for many, many years before he did, he got it taken out.
Question? If you pursue this analogy of the analogy of Jesse Garrix and everything, shouldn't you also look, shouldn't a bigger difference be between the middle and the sides? Because on the side, whether it's left or right, they're next to an ecological niche because they can colonize new stuff, the borders should be more, I mean, comparing the borders.
You're right. And so, but I'll go further because this is just the beginning. Okay. So we're comparing the right versus the left.
So for some reason, if right tumor can stop growing or something,
you
get a big difference.
Yeah, yeah.
That could be the wrong conclusion.
I agree. So, but we wanted to see what the data looks like, okay? And the more I think about it, actually, I've never done this experiment because it's probably too complicated. But the answer actually turned out to be very, very simple. Okay. So now we're comparing, we're looking at the pairwise distance within the gland, okay? So we take a gland and we take the average, the right side, average, the left side, and we see that they actually are correlated, okay? Right side, left side here. So if we take a gland from the right side, it has the same age as a gland from the left side, okay, at least based on diversity. Okay, so there's some correlation here, or as someone would say, symmetry, because basically we're saying the glands on the right side have the same age as the glands on the left side.
How do you decide how to plot this? What does it mean? So if you take any point, right, so the x-axis is what?
So this is we take, say, six glands and measure their intergland pairwise distance and get an average. And then we take from the left side, way on the other side of the tumor.
Also six glands.
Six glands, and then we see where they plot. Because if they could be skewed off one side or another, but they tend to fall along this line here. Okay, so that's sort of interesting because, you know, when you see lines like that, you say, hey, the right side looks like the left side. So
amusingly, right, this of course runs very much against the sort of neutral Kingsman coalescent intuition, but this is exactly what you expect in a non-neutral coalescent.
Okay.
Right? There is a delay before any pair coalesces, right? In the tree under selection, like lambda coalescent, right? You're talking with mathematicians. What's happening is there's no coalescence for a while, and then essentially everybody coalesces at the same time.
Yeah.
Of course, not really at the same time, but in a suitably scaled time units, it all happens, if you like, as your Big Bang.
Yeah.
That's just the signature of selection.
Yeah, so this is just like this, right?
Yeah.
Not like that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's sort of even more extreme in the sense that in the scaled units, all your sort of coalescence there will be
very overrun.
Rather compressed.
Yeah. And that's sort of like a Big Bang. It's just inflation and then nothing much happens. So, okay. So the right and left side. Okay. And then so older cancers have older glands. So here we compare a cancer, we look between the sides, and there's a lot of variation, but this is average. And so this is a young cancer, this is an older cancer between the sides. And a younger cancer actually has, this is the intergland pairwise distances. A younger cancer actually has younger glands, and an older cancer has older glands, okay? So the glands correlate with the age of the tumor. When you compare the age of the tumor being pairwise distance between the right side and left side, then the little bitty parts are actually almost, in this scenario, are almost the same age as the whole tumor, okay? So it's sort of like saying that if you're an old tumor, then your little itty-bitty parts are also old, okay? Which is consistent with maybe a first a single clonal expansion. Okay, so this is more consistent. Instead of being stepwise, when we randomly take these glands from the right side and left side, they all have the same age. We don't see a spread of ages. Okay, we can actually do more spatially oriented things. So this is our tumor here, and this is a section of the tumor. And we can say, let's actually define where we're going to sample, okay? Because we basically randomly take a couple of these, and they're all from the cell surface, because that's where they come out from. What about the deeper part here?
Okay, could I just get a clarificatory thing? So a gland is still a rather small thing, right? A little fold.
About 10,000 cells.
10,000 cells. So are you saying that this is slightly inconsistent with your the picture of things breaking up one by one? Because, or you would say that actually it broke up, the last breaking up happened a long time back.
The last expansion, yeah, long time.
And then after that, they just have continued and shred things.
Yeah, so they're dividing, but not there's no net increase in space, nor increase in cells. So time goes on, but space stops expanding.
Okay.
Sort of like the universe, time goes on, but the universe, the expansion slows.
And that's done by the new cells coming away, disappearing from the system?
So they
shed that.
They shed it, yeah.
Excuse me, since I never quite understood what the gland was in that stained section, in this photo, could you point out the gland? Is it of those little
hemispheres? Yeah, so this is about, say, 2.5 centimeters, and this is 2.5 centimeters.
Uh-huh.
And so you can't see these things, but there's little glands in here, and you can't even see it here, but there are.
Wait, so the glands are not particularly associated with the bumps on the surface. So it's not the...
Yeah, so this structure. Is not a gland. There's probably 1,000 glands in this little area here. It's not one gland. And there's, 1,000 glands there and 1,000 glands there. So. And then, so this would be, you would cut through the tumor this way, and we get a section here. And now, instead of just sampling from the surface, because you're right, the surface could be pretty uniform, we can actually sample from down here now. And there's a technique, which is very tedious, but you can, under the microscope, dissect out individual glands and compare the glands here versus here in very well-defined areas. And so...
Hey, Daryl, you can't tell the future here, though, can you?
Can I tell the future? I might be able to tell the future.
You might?
But you won't like it, so...
I wouldn't like it.
I'll tell you, but the future is a little later. Okay. And so we can actually microdissect individual glands from different parts. So this is the superficial area, okay, what we see out here, and probably what I sample when I get glands. And then this is the invasive part down here. Okay, then right. These are the ones that are invading, okay, and some people would say, this must be the newest part because, you started up there and then it invaded. Okay, and that no one would blink an eye if I said that. But when we do this and we compare the diversity within here, these little spots versus here, they're actually about the same. Okay, which is kind of surprising because if you think diversity is a measure of age, then these should be the newer parts. They should be less diverse. Okay, so it doesn't follow the idea. You started up here, and then something happened, and you got invasion. Okay, and we can also measure the difference between physical difference and pairwise distance. Okay, so we can actually measure. And so now we're going to compare pairwise distance, a measure of biological time, versus physical distance. So this is the sort of the structure of the universe. What is the relationship between time and space? Biological time and space.
I'm a little confused by this. You tell us that there is no motility, right?
No.
Right, you told us that there's no motility, right? So by the time you take these two red spots, even though they're alive and move, growing, they have not seen each other since their common ancestor, which was very long time in that tumor. So why is it surprising that they're as far apart in the tree as anything? Right?
Well,
it's you have these little islands, and they don't travel very much between islands.
Well, someone might say, well, this was a tumor here, and it was non-invasive, non-metastatic. And all of a sudden, one of the cells got a mutation, and that caused the invasion.
Well, no, of course, this has, I understand, a non-trivial consequence that it is basically the statement that the red things are not members of one recent clone.
Yeah, yeah. And this is.
But on the other hand, it is not entirely an expected consequence of localization there.
Yeah, yeah. Right? So it's
if
a way.
If they could travel by airplane, uh-huh. right? They would all perhaps mix, and only one of them take over.
Yeah.
But as it is, they don't see each other. They evolve independently, and this is somehow saying that there are many ways, at least at this stage in the tumor, to become invasive.
Yeah, yeah. So, but stepwise, you would expect to find some very younger, much younger clones. Okay, and this is where you would look. So we did look, and we don't really find that they're younger. So,
are they all the same age amongst themselves?
They could be. And so now, next, what we do is we're going to measure the tumor time space. So tumor time would be pairwise distance. And then physical space would be the distance between the spots.
And okay, that's actually exactly what I wanted to ask. So if you look at the tumors very close to each other,
uh-huh.
do you see that they're any closer genetically?
Yeah, that's what I did, and I do this. So this is physical distance. These are dots that are right close to each other. And then this is the pairwise distance of time. And we see this line here, and this is typically what we see whenever we do this, and it's sort of flat, in fact, it's statistically flat. And this means that the glands, these two areas next to each other, are almost as old as an area that's anywhere else in the tumor. Okay.
So this means that, according to Len's translation, the universe is the same age everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. So biologically, this is one clonal expansion, right?
I mean, for many tumors, that can't possibly be true. You know, there's necrotic cores and stuff. You know, that's the vision I have. You know, this expanding uh-huh. supernova explosion, leaving behind, you know, some ancient thing, uh-huh. and then outside is all this new thing happening. But you're not saying that. So is this? I'm not saying it's wrong, but it's just maybe so specific to your particular kinds of...
It could just be, you know, so when I do this, I get tumors that look healthy. And they're not...
You don't get necrotic cores.
No, because, you know, I think, wow, that's going to be really hard to do. And most actually cancers that come out of the colon don't have necrotic cores.
They do not.
Yeah. So
why not? I mean, I would guess they would, but I don't.
Well, you're right. Sometimes they do, but then I still sample. I can't sample from the necrotic area because the cells are dead.
Could I play devil's advocate? And I'm sure you thought about it. Okay, imagine I keep on bugging you about the rate of methylation change.
Yeah.
Okay. Imagine, God forbid, methylation and demethylation is very fast.
Uh huh.
Okay. So in that case, at some point, they become completely independent of each other.
Yeah.
In which case, also, you will end up seeing everybody roughly at the same distance, because that's the average distance between two random samples.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And you have thought about it, and you kind of ruled it out.
Well, I can't rule it out, but so as I showed you, when I look at different tumors, they appear to have different overall diversity.
But the way to rule it out is to see if different parts of the colon are the same age.
Yeah, and
they
do, actually.
Yeah.
So.
No, sorry. So I didn't understand the refutation.
No. So I'm saying the way you test it would be to see if different parts of a given tissue, normal tissue, is the same age. And clearly, it's
well,
not.
We have to know something about its age structure. Yeah, but you're right. Okay, so if take
stromal cells versus epithelial, you'll see
take regular cells
much
funny enough, and whether the size is roughly the same.
Yeah,
could be. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because again, I think I've raised this thing of the traditional numbers of few percent. To your 10 to the minus 5, and you have told me that those are artifacts. But if those are true, you'll actually get methylation pattern change in no time at all.
Yeah. So it could be that this is just a coincidence, but this is sort of I'm trying to be a physicist. I want to know if something.
I'm trying to be a physicist too.
Right? So I thought if I did this, I'd be, you know, I wasn't sure what I'd see, and you would think that you'd see something like this, maybe, right? But you see this, and so it's kind of interesting because it's not.
But wait. But there's a devil's advocate alternative explanation is that what one sees is not age, but
something else, right?
Right. That this thing is in equilibrium, right?
Yeah.
And one sees just the noise level.
Yeah.
And furthermore, it is not inconceivable that different tissues have different rate of demethylation, uh-huh. And then one will see different noise flow.
Uh-huh.
So the scale along these two axes is not the same.
Yeah, so this is pairwise distance. So this is.
But that's a Hamming distance.
Yeah, it's a Hamming distance.
And this is a physical distance.
Uh-huh.
That's right. Right. But that's
so
the correlation
changing,
to do.
I mean, there's a slight slope, right?
No.
So how about if the scale
no.
was so different that the slope would make
no.
it?
Well, but yeah. No. Yeah, if I showed it to you as a slight slope, you will kill me and say
no.
that it's not significant enough.
No, I don't kill you, but I'm saying.
Look at the actual numbers.
I'm noisy.
No, come on.
It's half of them.
2 centimeters, and there's very little pairwise distance. I mean,
what do you mean little?
No, we can
little. If you have two scales, they're different. If you have two scales, they're different. If I take a log of this scale.
Yeah. So if I take a younger tumor, it'll just be shifted down because it's a younger tumor.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay.
An older tumor just be shifted. This.
Okay, so you're trying to say okay, but what?
Let's get some questions.
If you do an enhancing tissue, do you get also the same or
the health? I've not really done this in healthy tissue because I sort of know the answer is all the same age, and one of the reasons why this probably works is that these tumors are actually not very old. So any. My basic assumption that they're drifting apart probably holds, but say if you looked at something with 10 years, you might see
obviously you have margins, right? So
uh-huh.
We look at the margins.
So these are actually at the margins here. These are the cells that...
Those correspond to farther distance of
pain. Yeah, these are the cells when a pathologist sees this, they say, oh, this is bad. This tumor has spread. And in our mind, these are the dynamic areas, but by this analysis, these things are actually, they look like they're moving, but they've been there and they're solid. But that's why pathologists have great imagination. And you can't be proven wrong, but if you show someone under the microscope, these are the ones that are invading. And that's what we actually say. We don't say this is invasion, these cells are invading. Then, you know, this is sort of dynamics, but we don't know anything like that.
So then could you have rapid expansion and then just static after a while?
Yeah, that's what I think happens. It's just rapid expansion. It's this born to be bad. You start out with this sort of called the almost your full malignant potential at the time of transformation, and you just grow out. Some tumors are small, some tumors are big. Nobody knows why that is, but I think it's because you have a certain malignant potential in the beginning and you don't evolve much further.
Well, they do colonoscopies. Do they suddenly find last year you were okay and this year you've got these huge things all over the place?
Uh huh.
That's what happens?
Yeah, and they think it's because the colonoscopist goofed. You know, because you go in there and you say there's nothing there, right? And then a year later the patient comes back, he's got stage 4 cancer.
So what's the deal with that?
Then he calls his lawyer and the guy says, no, I looked at the whole thing. And then he'll say, but why do I have stage 4 cancer? I was guaranteed that if there's nothing here, nothing should be there. And these things happen and then everyone argues, but...
But you think it is a very boom kind of thing happening.
Well, I think you could actually measure it, right? So if you had these things where the colon looked clean, and then a year or two later you get this huge tumor, you could actually measure these things.
Yeah.
So it's, nobody knows, but you could actually, you might be able to start measuring these things.
It's continuous.
Okay, sorry. Okay, so that's the idea then. If you were to draw a phylogeny, it would be a star phylogeny, so that everything, all the tips, since they coalesce late, have the same structure. So, okay. Which makes me think. Selection paradox. So selection in biology is like gravity. So So we just know it exists, and whatever it does, you're going to increase fitness. It's sort of like if you drop something, it's going to fall down. If you have any two cells, you're going to increase fitness. Okay. But in these glandular cancers, selection is local. The immediate competition is between the adjacent cells. So when we look at this cell here, and this cell here, and this cell here, these are the only ones they have to worry about. And then this cell here has actually nothing to do with the fitness of the cell here, right? And this is only a couple cells away, right? Because it has its structure here, and this is the battleground. But the battleground is just with the guy next to you, okay? And so this leads to a weird paradox, because the most similar cells, the cells that are most alike, are your neighbors, okay? And so this is really weird, because you're trying to do selection, but everyone around you looks the same. In fact, they're about as the same as they can be. Okay. And even though we say, and so this cell may have an advantage over this cell, but its neighbor, you know, everyone else is the same. And so this is just a weird thing. So how, the question is, how different must two cells be for efficient selection? Because the immediate daughter cells are the most identical you'll ever be, right? And so how many divisions do you have to do before you actually get enough of a different difference that you can get selection? Okay. But this is a weird thing, because most people think, well, if you get even a little difference, it's going to sweep. Okay. And so you can actually use pairwise or population diversity to measure the frequency of sweeping. And we talked about small populations, so I'm going to see what happens within these small glands. And so if you grind up a tumor and you see lots of heterogeneity, the typical thing is there's a lot of evolution going on because there's a lot of heterogeneity. And if there's a sweep, the easiest sweep is a small population, right? You sweep just a little bit, you don't sweep the whole tumor. So you might think if there's heterogeneity, then each of the little glands will be homogeneous because there's heterogeneity and you sweep the gland. Or you can still have the same amount of heterogeneity, but each one of the glands are individually diverse. Okay? And so when I see my glands look like this, I think, wow, it's not been a long time since there's been a sweep. There must be maybe no selection. And then people who do FISH, where this is fluorescent in situ hybridization, they look for different chromosomal abnormalities. And you can do this on a microscope slide. When they do it, they see that the different abnormalities, the cells are intermingled with each other. There is no sort of neighborhood of clones. They're mixed in here, okay? Which suggests that maybe there isn't a lot of selection going on within these glands.
You're ignoring migration completely.
I'm ignoring the migration completely.
Because that would explain all of this too.
It could, but there's just not a lot of mobility that could occur. And even if there is migration, where's the selection? You know, because you're having very diverse migrants come intermixing.
So could you tell us a little more about the chromosomal abnormalities at this stage? Because it really looks like it's happening rather frequently. So are we looking at cells with sort of serious genomic instability, or?
Well, this is a breast cancer, and there's just, we're not actually sure, we don't know really dynamics, but we just know that when they do this, and this is a pseudo-colored image, so they're just saying that we found these different combinations of alterations here.
But what are these, aneuploid?
These are like a deletion or a translocation. These are just various different, and I don't have it, but this is the real data here, where they look to see where the probes hybridize and the number of probes. And then this is a pseudo color of it, just showing that the cells next to each other could have very different chromosomal abnormalities. So, which is not what you expect if there's a lot of selection going on, because you would think that one of these cells would have an advantage in sweep.
I'd be very careful with that statement. I don't know whether I'd buy that. I mean, maybe you're right. It just seems a little. If the environment is heterogeneous,
yeah.
I don't know what that means. There's weak or no selection.
Yeah, so definitely the environment is heterogeneous, but as you get down to smaller and smaller populations, then the environment becomes more and more homogeneous.
I'm careful.
Are chromosomal abnormalities inherited clonally? I don't think so, because you have VFB bridges, right? And so you would imagine that in one division, you might imagine that the two daughter cells have totally different chromosomal abnormalities. So they could still be local. And be like this. So maybe this is not, doesn't invalidate.
It could be, but whenever I see genetic or genomic heterogeneity in a little area, I wonder if there's much selection going on.
How much of that is Photoshop at work, by the way?
Oh, this thing here?
Yeah.
This is pseudocolored, so they're just...
Yeah, I always worry about that, right? I
mean, yeah. So, but fish is actually quite good. You can actually count the...
I understand that, but then they have these color maps that, you know...
Yeah.
To make it look bright for the simple-minded, but I wonder. Yeah, I don't know.
So this is also, so this is my data, this is someone else's data. So other people find a lot of heterogeneity. Okay. And so the idea is that most of the trees look like this, and you have I think many tumors grow all at once, and so just like in this, it's all at once. So the idea is that if you start from a single point, okay, single zygote, single first transformed cell, big bang, and then you have a rapid expansion and a lack of selection, then maybe you actually end up with structures, time-space structures that have to almost always follow certain rules, right? And so I don't know what those rules are, but maybe they follow the same rules that. Okay. Preventing cancer death from metastasis. So if we believe Bob Austin, one way to prevent metastasis may be with a fast helicopter, okay? The idea is that there should be a system in place where if someone thinks they have cancer, they should get a diagnosis, and me as a pathologist should have a red phone, and I'll say, as soon as I make the diagnosis, I'll pick up the phone, we have one. We have to get this tumor out as quick as possible, because once you know anything, it's progression, right? And we want to take it out.
I'm not sure I said that, but anyway, I'm just listening here.
We want to take it out as fast as possible. So there should be a team of surgeons waiting somewhere in a helicopter, because as soon as I make that diagnosis, this should be an emergency, because the only way you can save someone is if you catch it before metastasis occurs.
I agree with that.
Okay, so this should be part of the healthcare system. There should be a red phone. There should be like in a trauma team, there should be a bunch of surgeons just waiting for you. Okay? Okay. So, but what is the reality? Okay, so this is the reality. This is time from the time a pathologist said you have cancer. Okay? And this is the time till surgery. Okay? And here's the median number of days. Here's for breast cancer, 37 days. This is 40 days for head and neck, and for colon it's 29 days. So this is the time I say, I think you have a cancer, to the time it's taken out. Okay.
Any cancer, any stage, any grade.
Any stage, any grade, yeah. And so there's, of course, a spread. Some of these poor people, if they had the diagnosis today, they'll have their cancer taken out next year. Okay. And this is just because of all the nuances that occur. You say, I want the best cancer surgeon. He says, I'm booked up for 3 months. Or I want this taken out, and they'll say, well, your insurance papers are not quite right. Okay, so there's a delay here. Okay, now you'd say, well, there's a natural experiment here, right? Because we have people who come in, have a diagnosis, or think they have cancer, and there's variable times between the time you get that diagnosis and the time you have it taken out. Okay, you'd say, wow, okay, this is a cancer epidemiologist. They'll capture that. Okay, this is a study that they say, does a delay in diagnosing colorectal cancer in symptomatic patients affect tumor stage and survival? And so they gather all these people who have colorectal cancer, and they say, well, when did you think you had, have the symptoms and all this? And then when did you have it taken out? Okay, and they do it for early stage and late stage. And then the two graphs are actually quite different.
What are the two graphs? Taken out early, taken out late?
Yeah, so this is survival, and this is survival in weeks. Okay, and this is the number of people still alive. They all start at 100%.
Blue and green are taken out early, taken out late?
So this is for early stage cancer, ones that hasn't...
Yeah, what are the two colors? What are the two colors?
Okay, so what would you expect? here these people do better, and here these people do worse. Yeah. So which ones had the longer delay?
Yeah.
And this is a median delay of 23.5 weeks. So these are ones that had you know, some of these had taken out a long time ago, and some of them had more recently. So what would you predict?
Well, it depends on the model. If you believe Bob's model, then
the ones that survive the pill delayed surgery will probably survive.
So this is sort of the embarrassing things that happen, is that the ones that have the greater delay, the ones where the insurance company said that, no, you know, you can't go to the surgeon here, you have to go to the, but he's booked up, I'm going to die, don't you know anything about cancer biology? I need my colon taken out.
Yes. Surgeons actually kill you, and you're just best to stay away from the hospitals altogether.
So, and of course, there's a lot of reasons why this might be true. You know, it could be that these people who delay longer are just different from the ones who, uh-huh, who get it done right away.
It's pretty funny.
It's like, whatever.
This is typical, because
we can also believe that the health system is good and that the units less urgent. I mean, we can believe that the system is working.
Okay.
But this data is conditioned, right, on actually surviving through, yeah, all exactly, the delayed surgery, right?
Yeah.
So they're all the ones that died before the delayed surgery,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's possible.
Yeah, yeah. So these studies are actually quite hard, and everyone who does these studies are trying to get mad at the insurance companies because they want care. They want to buy a helicopter. They said, you know, it would be neat if they had a helicopter because it would save lives. Everyone would want to buy a helicopter, especially if it would be effective. But they get all, in general, this is the results people get whenever they do this, is that it doesn't make any difference. Question?
So what about folks who just don't want surgery? Is there a plot that even goes higher than that? Because
I've not seen that data. It's hard to find people who don't want surgery, so.
What tumor is this?
This is colorectal cancer. So anyway, you see these sort of things, and then
they delayed because they were waiting for a better surgeon.
It could be.
That's
right. In colorectal cancer, it matters whether it's the ascending colon or the descending colon.
Uh-huh.
So there's no difference here.
Yeah, there's no difference here. So
actually, that's.
So this is the. Yeah. So obviously, you want to delay your surgery as long as possible. But this is different from what cancer biology. Because you know, if you don't know anything like this, you would think that you should have it taken out as soon as possible. Okay. And because it's this, as we see, it can evolve in a matter of days.
But so, could you correct this for what Boris said, which is, if you delay and you die, then you're not part of this study.
Yeah, so they try, there's been actually quite a few studies that trying to show that this diagnostic delay.
If you could bring the graph down, uh-huh, if you brought the green graph down, it would asymptote to the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. So this is actually pretty reproducible. There's very few studies that show it the other way, or show either a difference and it's just.
It wasn't stabilized, it seems to keep going.
Yeah. Well, this one doesn't stabilize because this is late stage cancer. So this is kind of interesting data, I think. And so I bring this in because as physicists, it's no good to have a theory that solves 7 of the 8 observations, right? Because when you do that, you're wrong, right? And in biology, if you satisfy 1 observation, you think you're right. And they'll say, well, what about these 7 other observations? They'll say, well, you know, my data is good for this. And if you actually satisfy like 2 different observations, then biology, you're almost proven. You know, they'll say, well, what about this? They'll say, well, that's just, we don't worry about that. Okay, so what we're trying to do is find some sort of model that fits all this. And of course, one of the things that might fit this is that, in fact, at the time of transformation, it's going to destine whether you're going to live or die just because it has a certain full malignant potential.
Are there any animal studies where you could control using the same surgeon and so forth, and you could just vary the...
You might be able to do it in mice, so. But you can imagine trying to get this by a study section. Because they would just say, this is just... No matter what we learned, it wouldn't really tell us anything.
I mean, the trouble with mice is that those are always xenograft implants, right? And so that I always find that very suspicious, as opposed to a...
Yeah.
I guess even like colon cancer mice, that folks about.
Yeah.
So in principle, you can do that. But what really bothers me is that this is colorectal cancer. So if you do the same study with liver cancer, it's going to be pretty
good. I don't know. I haven't looked because I don't want to look at everything, but this diagnostic delay is something that people really worry about, and they can't actually find evidence that it makes much difference.
Is there a, which hospitals these were in? Could you tell by?
This is actually
where they were. So is there a definition of better surgery? By looking at which hospitals are involved in.
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know. But this is just sort of this is looking at a completely different data set to see whether or not
they're irrelevant makes sense. Information.
So. Irrelevant.
Relevant.
Yeah, it's very relevant.
Completely relevant.
Because as I said in my talk, MSKCC is a very famous place, very proud of themselves for having a very high cure rate, but that's because it takes forever to get there.
Yeah.
So there's a selection bias. People who don't get there, they die at home.
Yeah, no, I think that could be true, but I just put this in here because I think this is an observation that many times is never presented. And this sort of, since we're worried about time and this sort of, you know, stepwise progression, it should matter. And it actually, at least in the observations, it's
hard. Has anybody plotted how far away you go from home to get surgery and whether that improves your survival or not?
That I don't know. you could be a cancer epidemiologist because they like to ask every possible question.
No, but for example, the instinct for poor people is to go close to where you are.
Uh-huh.
Right? And they get treated quickly, I guess, because. And so there could be an economic factor here that people who are poor will get surgery wherever they live, and there are very few good places around, and most people can't afford to go there.
Yeah. So there's actually a lot of studies. I just illustrated this because this is the first one I got on PubMed, and even they are embarrassed that this is what they found.
It's pretty embarrassing.
Yeah, yeah. it's sort of like the redshift. You see this redshift and you say, wow, it's kind of interesting.
So, sorry, before you transfer the new one. So just a question, what's the percentage of people that die before they get treated? So
most people actually don't die before.
Like 10%, 20%?
No, less than 5%.
Okay.
So, and that's why. Well, is this why there's a delay in surgery? Because if everyone was dying of their cancer, then there'd be no backlog. You know, the good surgeon would say, "This is interesting. I was booked for 6 months and no one shows up." So you know, it's because these patients are don't die right away that you can actually have this backlog.
You can clean your backlog by taking the day off. Right?
Okay, and then so it's maybe this equation might be right, my equation. The odds of getting that next hit is actually quite low. Okay, so the other thing is we look at this curve and it curves have a lot of information, and you ask, and physicists can say crazy things like why. So apparently, because in biology you don't ask why, but why does tumor growth slow with time? Okay, and we know that in this sort of model here, fitness increases and proliferation increases with time. So if you look at this curve here, you say proliferation doesn't increase with time. Okay. Which is kind of weird when you look at this graph, right? If you knew how to look at graphs. Okay, in fact, what it's saying is that both proliferation and fitness may be declining with time, which is because it's by slow down.
How do you know that? How do you know that selection is not playing a role here?
We don't.
Initially, they're not under selection, they're all growing.
Uh-huh.
At some point, they're so far away from let's say, the vasculature that they are under strong selection, and very few of them survive.
That's a good question. I'm going to actually address that. Okay. So, question.
Well, I was at this other cancer meeting, and this guy looks at the way embryonic tissue expands.
Uh-huh.
His theory is that cancer is originated in a particular form of tissue and are only allowed to grow there. And when they reached it, that line which delineates another form of tissue, they're not allowed to expand into that and they stop.
Uh-huh.
And he actually bases his surgery on that. So he doesn't cut away tissue, which is unnecessary because the cancer will never expand. They're in a ways.
Uh-huh.
And so he has this embryonic, boundaries. Yeah. And tumors are expanding through and then stop when they reach those embryonically determined boundaries. Is that part of this theory, maybe, that they're simply deliberately shutting down because they're not allowed to move beyond where they are?
That could be true, and I'm actually going to address that. So, because people say these things, and I want
to, I know.
I want you to actually see with your own eyes, because well, you guys aren't biased. You guys don't know the answer yet, so you'll see with your own eyes. Okay. There's something called Mueller's ratchet that most mutations, every time a cell divides, you actually get worse with age because most mutations are neutral or deleterious. Very few are advantageous. Now, here we have this tumor here, okay, and it started, and here this is like a microscopic part of it. These are the tumor cells here, the darker ones, the bigger ones, and these are the normal cells here, okay? Now, we don't know what the scale is, and then here's the stroma here, the inflammatory cells. But we do know at some point in time the tumor was very small, okay? And it had to get bigger. So what it does is it invades, okay? And this is the border. This is where invasion occurs. So it has to grow here, kill these cells, displace the cells, and keep going, okay? Now, it had to do this very early on, and it had to keep doing it, and it had to keep doing it, and it had to keep doing it. And if this is the edge of the tumor, this is just the same boundary it had before. It started out small. It's a small boundary, but it's the same boundary between here and at the edges here. They're all about the same boundary. They all have the same, we have to go to the next crypt, because the colon's pretty uniform, so it's crypt by crypt. It's sort of like, it's a river, in order to expand, it's a river you have to cross, or a colon crypt, you have to destroy it. You have to go to the next colon crypt and destroy it, next colon crypt and destroy it. So my idea is that fitness actually decreases with time. So the first transformed cell is this is a remarkable cell, it's like Herschel, you see, he can do anything.
I actually don't quite understand this picture, but can't the tissues will locally dilate,
uh-huh,
and just stretch the, no, so somewhere there is a boundary, right?
Yeah.
And you can ask, as the tumor expands, what is happening to, I'm having trouble thinking in 3D right now, so let's just think in sort of projection, right?
Uh-huh.
Just 2D, right? So there's a perimeter of the tumor. And by definition, on the outside of the perimeter, cells are normal.
Yeah.
Right? So now, suppose we start dilating this.
Right. So the is there evidence?
Is multiplying, the area is perhaps growing, and the perimeter with it. So the normal cells on the outside of the perimeter will presumably get stretched.
Or pushed away, yeah.
Pushed away means somebody has to move.
Yeah.
Right? So, right, either we, right, the number of normal cells on the perimeter is fixed at the moment, right?
Uh-huh.
So, of course, these normal cells are themselves crypts, and there are stem cells, and uh-huh, even normal stem cells, right, can divide. And so that number isn't really...
Yeah.
Fixed. So I guess I'm bringing this up to a crazy question.
Okay.
So can the tumor actually accelerate the division of normal cells?
I don't think so. It's not a...
Build more normal crypts?
I usually don't, as far as I know. We don't see like a bunch of normal cells that pile up here.
That's not going to happen though. I mean...
Sometimes, yeah.
They do give off growth factors. I mean, Boris's point is that that does happen.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's not like you grow a defense of epithelium. But this is sort of like a fractal problem in the sense that even if this tumor was really small, it still has this problem when it grows, it has to expand. So even if I said that the tumor ended here, it's a very small tumor, to grow it still has the same problem because the surrounding tissue is the same, okay? And if I said, no, this is the edge of a 10 centimeter tumor, it actually still has the same problem because it's the interface between the tumor and normal, okay? And so according to your surgeon, they say there's been some anatomic barrier here and it'll stop the growth, and that's why it stops, and that's the only reason why it stops. And then you would expect to see that you wouldn't see a round symmetric thing, you would see some sort of, you'd hit a barrier and then it would mold against the barrier, okay? But you see this thing, and of course, if in fact most mutations are neutral or deleterious, initially you start out with Hercules. They'd say, oh, this is not, no problem. I can bridge any gap. I can do whatever you want. I can cause angiogenesis. But with time, many more divisions, the thing grows. It used to be small and it grows. But now the cells have a few more mutations and maybe their fitness is going low. And so finally at the end, when it stops growing, it grows slowly. You end up like Bill Murray. He's Hercules now, right? He's not, these cells here are not.
Joe Murray?
Bill Murray.
Oh, okay. Right.
You know, so he's Hercules? He says, ah, he gads. What happened, Hercules? Oh, I'm a little bit out of shape. but so you could start out with very, you know, these cells are very much, they can do anything. But at the end now, these cells are tired. These don't, they have all these other mutations in here. And you ask them, you need to go and invade and kill these cells here. In the beginning, it was no problem at all. But now it goes, oh God, you know, I've turned off some genes. I have a deletion here. It's just not possible anymore. Okay, so maybe that's actually why fitness slows for time. That in the beginning, that first cell was very, it had actually the highest capability. So it could rapidly expand. But in the end, the population of cells are all very different from that initial cell, and that's why this growth automatically slows. And bigger tumors started out with a greater growth potential, and then they slow down.
But there's also a boring explanation,
right?
As in, you know, saturation, right? As in, any cell culture will expand exponentially, and then go in saturation regime, right? And then returning to I think it was Gann's question. So selection typically doesn't act in freely exponential, right?
Uh-huh.
I guess it's called log phase, right? But then kicks in the stationary phase. Well, I guess it's kind of the stationary phase, there's no proliferation at all, you know, there isn't much selection either. But at the turnover knee, presumably this is where most selection is acting, but also your argument about Müller's ratchet, you know, Müller's ratchet is fine, and most mutations are deleterious for sure, but a few beneficial mutations are enough to get the thing going forward. So just saying that most mutations are deleterious is another poor explanation for why things are.
Yeah, but why is it grows fast and then it slows down? So it could be lots of reasons, and I'm trying to say why it might do that. You know, it could be that.
Yeah, but there are many. But this is a rather exotic explanation, as opposed to, you know, simple and boring explanation. And I think this room was half full of physicists a few weeks ago who would have said that, well, you know, the tumor gets large, it's compressed, and then it just can't grow. Period.
Yeah, it could be, but
explain it by.
But when we actually look at the border of a tumor, it doesn't look like there's anything different. It doesn't, you know, if I look at the border of a small tumor versus a large tumor, it looks the same to me. This is just under the microscope. This is what we see. We can't say, I can't look at this thing here and say,
but
you know,
border,
this is a.
But the border would not give you exponential growth, right? If you're saying that the tumor is expanding only at the border, that immediately means that it's not expanding exponentially.
Yeah, yeah.
It has to expand in the bulk in order to grow exponentially.
But at some point, if we call this early enough, it was growing exponentially. So at the border, it was just invading like crazy. You had no
That's
problem.
Exactly what you'll find. You'll find the crossover from some two-dimensional growth, you know, that there is some sort of characteristic length, and the small tumor will essentially look two-dimensional.
Uh-huh.
And the large one will cross over to linear, because only near the boundary it can grow. So
that's if you're in the chronic cord.
Yeah, I know.
So anyway, this is with your own eyes, you can see the boundary doesn't actually look very different.
Right now we see only the small tumor there.
Yeah.
So you are saying that by looking at the eye, you don't feel that there is big stress at the boundary and cells are very deformed.
It would be neat if I could just look at a little thing like this and say, this is a 10 centimeter tumor. How do you know, doctor? If you look at the stress here, there's much more stress that's coming on from the mass of it.
Yeah.
And then I'd say, well, no, this is actually a very small tumor because there's no stress here. But I can't do that, you know, because I, when I look at the boundary.
But I think we have a problem
measuring here. I think you can't really say that.
Yeah, but just you would think, you know, I agree, but at least visually, it doesn't appear to be any difference between the boundary and a big tumor versus a little tumor.
Well, right, but it's not, that's what I'm trying to stress. It's not the boundary, right? It's the bulk, right? The big tumor has more bulk.
Yeah.
Right? And, I brought up mechanical stress, not because I particularly believe that that candidate, but just there was a lot of discussion. But diffusion, angiogenesis, any of the things that you're saying that you do not see in necrotic core there, but you do see reduced growth. So you're done. This is basically saying in the bulk tumor, for whatever reason that we don't quite understand, nutrient supply, hypoxia, whatever, it has saturated the growth. One doesn't really have to say that it has mutated itself out of competence.
Okay, but for some reason it slows down. It could be, one of the reasons it could be that.
We would keep
on smart.
But as we discussed last time, you can take big tumor pieces and small tumor pieces and put it somewhere else.
Uh-huh.
Run it in a poor mouse.
Uh-huh.
And then see whether they're genetically unable to grow anymore versus something. So you can settle this question, whether it's sort of the potentiality of the cell versus locally.
Yeah, so there's more you could do, and I just put out that it's... Okay. So how do we measure the first few cancer cell divisions? We use coalescent theory that we have the present day cancers and they all go back to a single cell, both the right side and the left side. And so what we're more interested in is the first cell division. What happens here? And if in fact there is some structure to the universe, that there should be some symmetry breaking. So that in the first cell division, whatever mutations occur and segregate asymmetrically, then they'll be imprinted on the different sites, right? Because once you have this, then half the tumor will have these mutations, and the other half will have the other mutations. And this is assuming a lot of things, but maybe you could find this, okay? And of course, so that's the first division, second division, third division. These are the first three divisions. And as you can see, the signal depends on the number of cells you get. And so as you get further out, the signal is going to fade away. So you can actually turns out it might be easiest to characterize the first cell division just because half the cells will have one common mutations and the other half will have another one. Okay, so this is the strongest signal. These are the clonal mutations. So this is the frequency on the right side. If you measure all these mutations, frequency on the left side. They're both the same, then those are the clonal ones that were present at in the first transformed cell. And then if they're present 1 versus 2, 100%, that would be the first cell division. And then the second cell division would become, the frequency would be less among the cells, and then so on. Okay, so the signal would die out, but potentially you could actually see the first cell division just because that signal would be so strong. Okay, and then the technology we're using here are these SNP microarrays, where we look at, say, 600,000 SNPs, and we say, are they present, are they heterozygous, what are the signals? So you can sort of, this is copy number variation or a weird way of doing cytogenetics. And the good thing about it is that you can do it on these small glands if you do a few tricks, and you're also looking genome-wide, so it's not, you're looking at one chromosome, how do you know what happens to the other chromosome? Okay, so the idea is that if there's symmetry breaking, you can conserve that you don't lose a chromosome, it just gets differentially partitioned, you might be able to see this. Okay, so this is some data. This is a cancer, and I'm just exhibiting two glands from one side. This is one gland, another gland, chromosome number one, chromosome number two, one gland, two glands, left, right. And the same on here. So if we look at chromosome number one from this side, this is triploid. Okay, it actually has three, I'm not going to explain it too well, but these are three copies. Okay. And if we look at the other side of the gland, we look at two glands, one gland versus two glands from the right side, this is diploid. Okay? And on contrast, down here, on this side, this is diploid, and that's triploid. Okay. Now when we look at these things, on the left side, these are all triploid. Okay? And they're all the same between the different glands. And then we look at the corresponding glands over on the other side.
And these are actually all diploid.
Okay? So the same ones that are triploid over here are diploid over here. Okay? Then we look and say, these are the ones that are diploid here. Okay? Now on this side here, these are actually triploid. Okay? So the same. This is really weird because So these are, the green ones are diploid, and then over here, the same ones, same chromosomes in the same tumor, but not
on... What is the X chromosome?
X chromosome, I think, is this one here. And it's from a male cell. Okay. So we see this almost, if it's diploid here, it's triploid here, and if it's triploid here, it's diploid here, which is really weird. And then these two chromosomes here and here are diploid in both cases.
So a single cell fusion event would explain this, right, with asymmetric...
Yeah, so you might... So this is really weird, because and this is why I think we can do this, because some of the data I have looks weird like this. It's sort of like you had one cell division and something got partitioned in a weird way. So in this case, you might start out with this first transform that for some reason was...
Duplicated.
Yeah, 5N or something, and then it partitioned out, and then forever then you...
Or you could have a fusion event. First.
Yeah, or something weird going on. You know, there's a lot of things, but whatever happened, you sort of see that you can actually see this sort of imprint on that first cell division because it's a symmetric expansion, and just like in the Big Bang Theory, you see these little ripples from the past, and it could be a very strong signal if you were looking for it and you set it up. And it's interesting because in speciation, they often say that speciation occurs when an organism becomes polyploid, and then so it could be that sort of these creation events, at least biologically or information-wise, are associated with vast changes in chromosome number. Question.
So how often do you see a thing like this?
Well, this is the one I could see myself because it was so striking. And we have actually a bunch of things like this, and none of them are as striking as this. But you've
done this on some number of samples,
uh-huh.
And so one can actually look and see, more or less statistically,
uh-huh.
Uh-huh. What happens.
Yeah, it could be most of the time that first transformed cell, nothing much happens. So this is just a dramatic example of it. Because it looks so weird, and
yeah, Jim Shapiro talks a lot about this right now.
The polyploidy,
gene shock, he calls it.
Yeah, yeah. So is it true, right? Because no one can see that first transformed cell. What happens at the time of transformation? This is something we'll never see because you can't see in humans. What happens that
you have the SNPs, right? So you could tell what happened. You can
look
at the SNP distribution, and you can see whether it's a single, the triploid.
Yeah. So there's a lot of information, you know, with these SNP chips that you could actually look at because, well, if you do it properly, you could do a lot with it, and we're trying to do that. But this actually approach to actually look at the first cell division in the cancers, I don't know. It just seems really weird that you could do that. But I think you could. In fact, you'd know more about the first cell division than you would know about whatever happened later on. The idea is that there must be something that we can do. Okay, so anyway, this is the idea of, I like physics because it's logical, and you can actually do this while you're not, you know, you actually have to think every now and then, which is kind of fun. And then, is it highly possible for human cancer to use logic? So, you know, instead of just grinding up a tumor, you think, well, is there a better way of sampling a tumor than just grabbing a tumor? And people would say, yeah, the better way is to get more tumors. And then, but if you had a tumor, how would you sample it? What would you do? And then it may be possible to see in vivo. And this is the event I think we're trying to prevent, that first cell transformation. But we have no idea what happens. And of course, this is the work of many, many individuals. Half these people speak math. Okay, I'm sorry I went over.
So that first cell and chromosomal instability, so is this sort of the beginning of the end, or is there also evolutionary prehistory of that particular founder cell? So, which allowed it, you know, the other five mutations of the six required that made possible chromosomal instability without apoptosis. And
So that may be why P53 is so common. In order to get to that sort of state before you actually become aneuploid but not transformed. If you had normal P53, that could never occur. And so you can sort of begin to use contingency to help explain why you see certain things once you...
But that would basically make that founder cell not really the beginning, but the beginning of the end.
Yeah. So again, there's that area that goes before, but it could be that it's a singularity that before that you can't actually measure, but when you have a tumor, you can actually measure that event, that first cell division or something. I find that I'm going to try and do that just because it seems like a neat thing to do and
tumor universe or something. So I think we started in May, I think it was May or May 21st, so a long time ago, and it's kind of we conclude a long journey here, month and a half. So we started like with oncogenes, tumor suppressors, signaling, network gene expression, metadata, meta sequencing, all sorts of things. There was this kind of issue about development of biology, a lot of developmental processes were discussed. And then we went to the cancer cell growth, which then led to like discussion about how cells grow in 2D, 3D, different behaviors, social behavior of cells, and then also tissues, you know, how tissues are generated and how mechanical stress is important in tissue and cells. And a lot of interesting issues, extracellular matrix, tumor microenvironment, came up, and angiogenesis came up as part of the tumor microenvironment. So that was another issue. We had a discussion about tumor growth, and I think towards the end, really growth up the tumor. And so I think we really looked at the colon cancer in many occasions, and also brain tumor, as well as breast cancer and other cancer as well. Also, I think we had discussion about like, different model systems going all the way to bacterial cells and then yeast and Drosophila, so covered all the different model systems. And we had a lot of discussion about metastasis and also drug resistance and chemotherapy. So we covered all those things, and why we were doing this, why we were discussing, having a lot of discussions. New York Times ran three articles, and David Gross kind of pointed me to those articles, and those articles came out this week, written by Gina Comarca. Yeah, and she mentioned about like, you know, three cases of the remarkable stories regarding personalized medicine. And in one of the cases, I think a doctor at Washington University who was studying the tumor actually had the same tumor. And so therefore, I think everyone at Washington University got together and decided to pool results and sequence his DNA, which led to the molecular target. Unfortunately, there was a drug against the molecular target. And so that made a big impact, and there could be a lot more coming up. So there'll be a lot of personalized medicine and new treatments and new drug resistance. I think a lot of new things will come out in the future, and those should be discussed in the future. So I think a lot of interesting things are going on while we were discussing, and we should continue discussion, I think. I think workshop was kind of put together, I think, by Ari Levine, who really put a lot of effort to giving like long lectures, tutorials in the beginning. Robin Bruinsma, Jean-Francois Joni, who helped put together the program. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to come, but he put together things, and then myself. But I think we should really thank Boris and his people here for really helping us out and hosting this and kind of giving a lot of great advice. So I think we want to thank Boris.
I think we really want to thank the organizers, and the various absent ones, because you guys made it happen and saw it through, and really thank you.
And then let's thank all the participants. Some of you have been here from the very beginning and involved in discussions, and we hope to see you again. Thanks.
So maybe one more word. It would be really helpful if all of you wrote sort of a couple paragraphs about things that you learned, you found interesting, things that you're taking away with you from all the discussions here, and or questions, suggestions for future programs, that kind of stuff. That would really help put things together. So thank you.